Al Whitney, welcome to In Defense of Humanity on this 14th day of October, 2017. This program is about helping people reawaken to the wonderful qualities of our own species while accepting and understanding that the current corporate commercial legal structure, both government and businesses built upon, is actively seeking to take control of most organic life forms on our planet. Restoring our unalienable rights and preserving our planet will require that we, the people, understand what has happened and learn how to empower ourselves as living men and women. Much of the information discussed on this show can be found on my website, anticorruptionsociety.com. If you need to remind yourself why humanity is worth defending, please read and enjoy the In Defense of Humanity page listed at the top of my website. I'd like to make new listeners aware that there is a free People's Empowerment Guide to our corporate commercial legal system on my website called Lawfully Yours. It is a collaboration of many men and women in the legal accountability movement. You can locate it by clicking on the Lawfully Yours tab at the top of my homepage. Our guide has been viewed more than 60,000 times since it was posted 2.5 years ago and is now in its 9th edition. We keep adding to it as more information and ideas come to our attention. This guide contains valuable strategies for challenging the non-existent authority of our corporate government. Well, tonight, I would like to talk about a topic that we mentioned, I believe it was last week. I did a little more research, and that would be the kosher tax. Last week, we talked a lot about who is our enemy, who is our number one enemy in this country. And tonight, we're going to talk about one of the devices that they have put in place that they are using against us. Every day, each and every one of us, every day. And most of us are unaware, I have to admit, 2 years ago, I heard an interview on Red Ice Creation. That's Henry Palmgren's radio show out of Sweden. And it was absolutely mind-blowing. I'd never even heard about the kosher tax. So I just listened intently, and I learned a lot. Well, I found that interview that Henrik did, and I kind of condensed it to make it as concise as I could, and we're going to be listening to it tonight. I'd have to check with Ken to see if it's done downloading, because it's going to take an hour to listen to it, but it is one of the best discussions of this topic I have ever heard. I don't think I would invite Dennis Fetko is his name, on the show, because I'm not sure he could do any better than he did in that interview with Heinrich. They covered the whole topic. They covered a bit of the history, how it works in the grocery stores, how it's affecting mom and pop's businesses, the whole nine yards. I mean, they pretty much covered everything in one interview. And one thing they didn't put in, however, is this kosher tax. And they talk about the little insignia or trademark of the kosher tax that you can look for on your food. And lo and behold, I found it everywhere. They did not mention, however, that they've also managed to put a kosher tax on laundry detergent. And I think dish soap, in other words, far more objects than just the food you're going to consume. And that, to me, was really startling. It was household goods. And why would we need a priest to bless or to look at the manufacturing of household goods is beyond my wildest. But tonight, this discussion will help explain this topic to a level that I think we'll finally all understand what is really going on and how it's affecting each and every one of us. I don't know that we'll come up with an easy answer to undo this, but it's the same people, folks, that we talked about last week and the week before. So why don't we do this, Ken? Let's just play it from beginning to end. It's about 56 minutes, and you can break in for commercial and then continue. And when it's done, I will take callers. You might want to get out a piece of paper and a pen and take some notes, because some of this is really going to surprise you. I have no doubt. Okay, let's listen to Henry Palmgren. This Henry Palmgren from Red Ice Radio, talking about the kosher tax. And this conversation took place in 2015. However, the material is just as relevant today as it was then. Okay, let's roll it.
Hello, I'm Henrik. RedIceCreations.com is the website. We are talking with Dennis Fetko today. He is the author of The Illuminatus Observer and hosts Inside the Eye Live. He brings weekly insights on geopolitics, Zionism, conspiracy, history, finance, and Middle East politics that shed light on our contemporary reality. Dennis is an American expat living in Amman, Jordan, that specializes in aerospace, defense, and telecom. So he's back with us today on the program to talk about the secret of a hidden tax, a hidden symbol or mark that shows up on virtually all foodstuff on the American market, but also in Europe and many other countries around the world. Can you imagine the uproar if it was, found out that the Pope and the Vatican placed a special religious tax on basically all food that you bought, and that this money was helping them to fund another crusade, let's say? Well, this is basically what is happening, but it's a different religious group that has done this, a minority that we're not allowed to criticize, that has forced itself onto many shelves in most supermarkets, again, then especially in America, but also on many big brands that show up all around the world. Wouldn't you like to know if this was the case? Wouldn't you want to know if you had to pay more for your food than necessary? And if so, wouldn't you want to know where this money goes? We will be talking about the kosher tax and the kosher mark. And if you haven't heard about this before, I think you'll be quite surprised to learn the truth about how the food industry has been hijacked by foreign interests. Today, we wanted to talk about the secrets of the kosher tax. This is actually a topic I wanted to address for a long time now. And I remember you did a show on this, Dennis, a couple of years ago. And I found out about it many years ago as well. And specifically, when I've been visiting the U.S., I see these K's and U's and parve symbols, like some kind of secret mark on basically every product every time I turn it around, because I'm pretty adamant about checking the ingredients and stuff like that. So you kind of, take a look at the backside of the products. But it's basically on all the products I've seen, but there are a few exceptions. But I'd say especially on the organic and the healthier ones, every time I go into those, American chains like Whole Foods, or, you guys have some really good options when it comes to organics and stuff like that that we don't have in Sweden. But every time I do, I see these symbols, and I know that you've talked about this, and I wanted to really do a good show in exposing this and see what the hell this is all about. And so tell us about your background in this, Dennis, and how you got, you know, smart to the kosher tax.
Well, I mean, I've obviously growing up, Henrik, in a Christian family, you know, in my area, we were always aware of what we call these Jewish dietary laws. You know, you learned about it in Sunday school. You learned about the shellfish. Oh, they can't eat shellfish. And you always mocked and kind of scoffed at the fact that they couldn't eat a cheeseburger, right? And so things like that were always part of just growing up. And then when I went into high school, I actually had a Orthodox Jewish girlfriend, believe it or not. And boy, one day I brought some pork home, and I wasn't thinking, to her home, and I cooked it there. And boy, did I get hell for that, and I forgot all about it, their dietary laws. So, you know, I've been aware of this for ever since I was a kid, basically. But what I really started to take notice of this, you know, coming into the 1990s, you know, back in the 1990s, America had a lot of innovation going on. And the reason why we did that was because we had a lot of different deregulation. We had the deregulation of our energy markets, which created this Enron scam that blew up towards the end of the 1990s. You had the deregulation in telecommunications, which I also played a part in that, in the Los Angeles ILEC-CLEC markets. But also you had the deregulation of the vitamin and health supplement industry under what was known as DSHEA. And DSHEA was the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, and this was 1994. And that created an explosion of sales of health supplements in the United States. I think 4 years after that act was created, it created over $4.5 billion in sales. And it was through working in this industry that I really became aware of the growing influence of Jewish power relative to food labeling and how they controlled access to our food, and this idea of a kosher tax. That's really where it all started to come from.
Interesting. Yeah, exactly. There's just so many, there's different symbols, there are different kind of meanings behind them. And as I started looking into it too, it seems like some are there to denote obviously the quality of the product. I've actually heard other rabbis saying that it's not about the quality, it's actually about just kind of getting a cut of every product, basically. But there seems to be, and this might be not true, but it seems that some are marked differently, implying that these are good, these are the healthy products that you do want to get for. Have you found anything that kind of separates the different type of symbols that mean different things, or maybe I'm just reading too much into that?
No, I mean, you have so many organizations. You know, you've got, if you go to, where was that thing we were looking at earlier? But you have, like, what they call reliable certification companies. So if you go to the United States, you know, you're talking about, like, 225 organizations out there. You've got the Alaska Kosher of Kabod of Alaska, and they're part of the Lubavitch movement. You've got the Congregation Shofetz Chaim in Arizona. Just so many are out there. The KOF, K circle F or dash K, who knows how it's actually written out there, but it's like a kof with a K on it, a Hebrew letter. This is coming out of Los Angeles with ties to congregations in New Jersey. So you can, there's just so many out there. It's really hard. You've got like a K, a CC with a K, which is the Kabbat of Fresno. And so you've got so many different certification outfits out there. But really the key one is, of course, the Circle U and the Circle K, Circle U, the Orthodox Union. And this is the oldest running organization going back to 1925. It's business. It is the most prestigious, certainly in U.S. commerce, food labeling. It's almost like as ubiquitous as Underwriters Laboratory on electronics instruments and electronic products. It's so prevalent now that it's almost impossible to pick up a good in a supermarket and not find this Circle U.
Exactly, and that's, of course, the trouble, because what if we don't want to contribute to this? I mean, if this is a religious tax, if this is, I mean, because we have no idea where the money is going, and despite, I mean, is the money coming out of the consumer's pocket, or is it coming out of the manufacturer's pocket?
Well, of course, Of course it's going to come out of the consumer, because food is always at a cost-plus basis. So you're going to take your raw materials, your processing, your transportation, everything, combine it in, and then you're going to add it together and then do a cost-plus pricing structure. So, of course, it's going to come out of the consumer. That's just straight up at the retail level. And then, of course, or at the wholesale level. And then you've got the per cost to print that little sticker. So if you've got that little circle U, maybe that alone is also going to be an additional charge. So you've got your certification charges where the rabbis fly out there. You're going to pay, the manufacturer are going to pay that rabbi to get on that airplane. You're going to pay him to do the search. You're going to pay for everything that they do. And this could be a reasonably small fee to the manufacturer. But you have to understand, the manufacturer may have a set of ingredients. So a rabbi is going to go into this organization, or this company is going to say maybe he sees 15 different ingredients. Well, guess what? Those 15 ingredients all have to be certified. So now you're talking about certification, not just the end product, but you're talking about certification on 15 additional products. And it's not just the 15 additional products, but you're going to have the certification on the plant equipment. So if it's using some type of stainless steel, well, that stainless steel can't touch certain items. And if it touches certain items, well, then that's going to become unkosher. So therefore, you're talking about literally certifying the entire supply chain, from the equipment to the processing to if you're using ladles, okay, to stir up whatever you're cooking up, that has to be kosherized. If you're using aluminum foil to press things, that has to be kosherized. All of this is getting added into the process. So to say that the consumer doesn't pay for it, well, I'll tell you, that's like saying, that's just dumb. Of course, they're going to pass that cost along. Mm-hmm. So this idea that it doesn't cost anything, we've been hearing that canard, to use that Jewish phrase, for a long time. But come on, guys, you're talking a $12 billion a year market minimum if Circle U is, as they're saying, actually certifying over 1 million products.
Wow.
That's just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. So, before we talk more about, potentially where the money goes and how much it is and all that, because we have many different types of marks, let's just kind of explain what you know about what it means. How does a company get this mark on there? And I guess an extension to that be because this is what I'm wondering. Sometimes I've turned around these kind of obscure smaller manufacturers, and it's like it could be whatever. It could be like a wheat free kind of dessert or something, like a cookie, and it's like the small manufacturer somewhere in like Idaho or like North Carolina that's producing something. And then there's a kosher mark on there. I'm thinking, wait a minute. I wonder if they actually approach, them and ask, oh, can we please have a kosher mark here? Or it's the reverse. I have no idea how the industry works in that way. Do you have any insight on that, Dennis?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a process of two ways. I'm sure, knowing it's a Jewish organization, right, they've got their salespeople. They've got their guys out there pumping up the sales, trying to say, hey, go get us some more factories. Another way is if you just go to these various organizations. The websites have right on it a nice little pull-down menu, get certified. And, of course, part of that certification are non-disclosure agreements and cost structures, and you'll get a price quotation. And it really comes down to that. You can just go get certified. And also, you've got problems with distribution. You may not actually get on a store shelf unless you're kosherized. And that, of course, is a big problem, because that means good products may be getting boycotted simply because they're not kosherized. Certain distributors may tell you, no, in order for you to pick this up, you need to get kosherized. You need a kosher stamp for this. So,
yeah.
So you've got a lot of this little scams going on that are not publicly made. But I recall very clearly, I represented a product called Dairy Cow. And Dairy Cow, this was back in the 1990s, it was made it's calcium, but it's made from the stream that's pulled off of the cheese manufacturing that goes on in New Zealand. And as you know, New Zealand is a major manufacturer of hard cheeses.
Mm.
And that calcium, nothing gets wasted in the food industry. Everything is processed into something. Everything. I mean, even the bones of a cow, bone
candy turns into candy, yeah, or whatever.
Oh, really?
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read a few from Amazon.com. Dr. Sam Serino reviewed the Extendivite product. Good ingredients, feeling much better since taking product. It seems that the tablets work well. Once again, thank you for your product. My acid reflux is really improved thanks to the Extendivite. Together with my thumb joints, the pain is gone and I'm able to grip things much better. My friend has peripheral arterial disorder and their lower legs were hurting at a red color, but thankfully there has been a significant improvement. Kind regards, Janice. My husband feels a big difference using Extendivite. Thank you. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. As most of you know, my regular listeners, I offer energy cleaners for sale at my website. If you don't have a clue what I'm talking about, go to my website, thelibertyman.com, educate yourself about these marvelous healing devices. We focus on pain mitigation and getting a great night's sleep. Arthritis pain, joint pain, back pain, doesn't matter. Keep in mind, I offer for me to you personally a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's what I do. Energy cleaners, $285, shipping included to American zip codes. You can educate yourself all about the energy cleaner right there at my website, the patent application, the wonderful testimonials. Be sure and check out the factory-made fitted mattress pads to go with the energy cleaner. Now, I offer for me to you personally a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's what I do. I have a toll-free order line, or you can order it right at my website at thelibertyman.com. The toll-free order line is 800-592-9543. I say again, 800-592-9543. Thank you.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more, plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
What they use that for is they use it into a type of thing that goes into making cardboard boxes.
There you go. All right.
The glue that goes into making cardboard boxes is actually made from a lot of this powder. The bovine bones is ground up into powder. And so nothing gets wasted. That's the whole point here. And the calcium is pulled off, and this guy came up with a way to press it into a nice tablet. Very flavorful. He packaged it in a nice milk carton. It really looked kind of cool, you know, because, you know, the milk carton, the old milk carton that you opened up, right? Going back to the 70s, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with those cartons, but you open it up and it kind of pulled the tap, you know.
Yeah.
You remember?
Sure.
Okay. It's like a milk carton.
Yep.
And the packaging was clever. I liked it. So I said, you know what, let me take this. I flew out to meet with, what do you call these guys? Walmart. I flew in. I got my 15 minutes of fame at Walmart, and then I met with some of the major distributors on the East Coast that were willing to take up the product. They said, look, try to get this to go regionally down in the Southeast, you know, like Florida, South Carolina, Georgia, these areas. And if it can go there, then come back to us and we'll see if we can pick it up type of thing. Now, the company finally said no, but I remember meeting, going to these various like dietary supplement, natural health trade shows and meeting with distributors. And all the time they would ask me, is it kosher? Is it kosher? Mm-hmm. Is it? It was almost like a mantra, like if it's not kosher, we're not going to take it. Because sometimes it was often in a, not often, but sometimes you could feel like this snide arrogance. Well, if it's not kosher, you're just not cool. You know, you're not going to get, we're not going to pick you up. And of course, if you don't get picked up by these major distributors, you have zero chance to get into the store shelves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So let's talk about what the process involves as far as, you know, sometimes a rabbi comes out to the manufacturing plants, as you said. What do you think they do, and how do they reform things to be able to put their stamp on it? Is this something that actually is based on something scientific, or is this like superstitional religious stuff?
It's superstition and religious, period. There's no other way around it. I mean, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back and what we really do in the food industry.
Sure,
and the supplement industry. Now, when you look at what's called DSHEA is the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. And, of course, this is a big, big business in America and growing worldwide. And what it does, it defined back in 1994 dietary supplements as food and not drugs. That allowed people to it created innovation in that space, you know, so people could actually go out there. And DSHEA granted, it still grants to this day, of course, the FDA this authority to regulate the dietary supplement industry in two really important aspects. One is that it must have this proper product labeling. And if you're going to make a claim, like, you know, it helps you with bowel movement or whatever the case might be, right? You know, you have to have backed up research for that. You must be able to support it. And that created a lot of growth because a lot of guys were doing a lot of great science on herbal supplements. And when I was working there, I learned about three different things. I learned about, obviously, DSHEA. I learned about something called GMP, or Good Manufacturing Practices. And what GMP is, it's really all about just good quality control and how you make things. So also it was known as CGMP, or Current GMP, or Current Good Manufacturing Practices. And these regulations, these are enforced by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And you had things basically to strengthen your quality control, the purity of the drug products if it's dealing with drugs. And, of course, you've got two different styles of CGMP. One would be like for the U.S. Drug Administration, or not drug, USDA. I'm not U.S. Dairy or something. I forget what USDA is now. I'm out of states for so long. But you have FDA and DA. Yeah, so U.S. The Food and Drug Administration and USDA. These two areas controlled GMP, and of course, all the products had to be made by this GMP process. And it's very, very, the oversight is extensive. And as we already know, we have very good standards through these practices. And the last item was something known as the Codex Alimentarius, which is basically a global book about food. And it's expected to, when it finally gets fully released, to be like 14, 15 volumes. And it's a global standard on basically food, food products, food additives, how to prepare food, safety standards. There's elements on parasites and other types of food, harmful things that come into food. And that's documented now in a policy called HACCP, which is the hazard. And what was that thing called again? Hazard and what was CCP again? I forget HACCP.
Yeah, hazard analytics critical control points, right?
So all of these items already are going into our food, okay?
Right.
These are all based on our Western type of rational science where we have committees. I myself, Enric, because I had one of the only GMP manufacturer and FDA approved facility in China for chondroitin sulfate. The only one, I joined up and joined as a non-paying member with the working group for chondroitin sulfate. And with that, you know, you were meeting with the people from Cargill, from Rexall, from Liner Health, from everybody and their brother who was interested in promoting chondroitin sulfate. They were there working this committee. And all of us are making our recommendations to obviously sway the process of chondroitin sulfate to give us a competitive advantage. At the end of the day, I mean, that's what you're using this for. Yes, it's science, but you're always trying to twist it to marketing. Or maybe okay? Because I'm kind of like an engineering / marketing guy combined. So I've joined these. I've seen how it works on the inside.
A note on that, too, by the way. I don't know if you remember, Dennis, but it's a side note, but just because it is, you know, allegedly scientific or drawn.
be heard.
Do you worry a lot? If you're forgetful, nervous, moody, or overwhelmed, chances are you're not protecting yourself from the ravaging effects of stress and anxiety. No matter the cause, ongoing stress and elevated levels of the stress hormone cortisol can rob your memory, your health, your quality of life, and your future. Now you can combat the effects of stress and anxiety while improving your memory and recall at the same time with the dietary supplement Calm and Clever. Studies show that the ingredients in Calm and Clever reduce cortisol by as much as 30% in as little as 1 to 2 weeks and increase your ability to recall facts, names, and numbers in 4 to 12 weeks. Calm and Clever was created by scientist Kurt Hendricks, a principal investigator in 2 NIH-funded studies on Alzheimer's disease. Try Calm and Clever for 2 months. You'll feel the difference. Call 1-800-758-8746 or go to calmandclever.com.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
With those outlines, there's, of course, major corruption and shit like that within these. You remember Codex Alimentarius was a major, you know, blow to this. Of course, it didn't turn out as bad as some people predicted. I mean, some said that it would be, you know, millions of deaths in 2013 due to the implementation of Codex, and that obviously didn't happen. But they've really severely diminished, like, nutrients in foods and stuff like that, and that's, I think, partially why some people are actually very, very sick, because it's the standards are not the best always, you know. But go ahead.
Well, that's the marketing side of it. Again, those markets, those decisions are going to be made to benefit a certain organization that are part of these working committees, and
yeah,
that's something people need to understand. And I always recommend people get involved in these committees and understand how they're working. That's the only way you can influence at the core level. I mean, is just start to take over the committees.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so how do we go from there over to, I know you've worked on the inside here and everything, so what happened there if we move forward in the timeline and go up to what actually happens when the rabbi kind of comes in and what they based this on, basically, their different decisions here?
I mean, again, it's difficult to understand what they're doing, you know, at the end of the day. I do have information as to what the rabbis are doing, though, of course. Just let me find it. You jumped really fast on me there, Henry.
Well, we can back up if you want. I don't mean to jump ahead there, Dennis. So please continue
my
the flow there.
Is that, guys, already, because a lot of people think that kosher is safer. People think kosher is healthier. People have this misconception about just what is kosher at the end of the day. You know, everybody likes to think, oh, kosher, if it's kosher, it's better. If it's kosher, it's safer. But really, we already have an extremely effective global regimen for the control of our food. This is what keeps us alive at the end of the day. None of us need a bunch of prancing rabbis going around certifying our food for us and then having us pay them for this service.
Yeah.
And then taking our money and putting it into yeshiva schools or whatever they want to do with this, which is exactly what these guys are doing. Now, what is kosher at the end of the day? Kosher is something that conforms to the regulations of what is called kashrut, or Jewish dietary law. This food is supposed to be, it can be consumed according to, again, halakha, which is Jewish law. And the term kosher is actually an anglicized word from the Hebrew term kasher, meaning fit for consumption. So really, the word itself is a bit misleading, because already the food is fit for consumption. We don't need anybody from the Jewish community charging us a fee to eat something that we already know is fit for consumption.
Yeah.
So in Hebrew, kashrus, again, is this root for, again, kosher. Now, the laws of kashrus are very comprehensive because you're dealing with 2,000 years of rabbis just going round in circles, making things up out of their head. Because you've got Leviticus, you got Numbers, or you got, I forget, Deuteronomy and Leviticus are two of the books where we can find some of the laws. And then they say, oh, but the rest are from the oral traditions handed down to Noah, which is absurd. Okay, now we're back into plain fairy tales again, which we talked about on our last show.
Mm.
You've got these guys literally talking about what was orally given to Noah. So these guys are just making junk up out of their head. And then wanting to create laws around it so that basically they have importance in a particular society. You know, an interesting side note about kosher, some people have said that kosher laws were actually made to push Jewish people as far away from the rest of the mainstream human body as possible by making laws so convoluted just about eating that it would separate them from actually the math and the book of humanity. As part of this chosenite strategy, perhaps by higher power or whatever the case may be.
Hmm.
Now, what you have in kosher are really the three products, meat, dairy, and this parev, parev being basically everything that's not meat and dairy. Meats, according to Torah, they can only be eaten by like cattle and game with cloven hooves, okay? Okay, and they have to chew the cud, okay? That's so now we're getting into this is – you know, they take this stuff very literally. So if an animal species fulfills only one of these conditions, for example, the pig, which has the cloven hoof but does not chew the cud, or a camel, which chews the cud but does not have cloven hooves, then the meat, it can't be eaten. Okay?
Right.
It can't eat. Mm-hmm. Examples of this then are bulls, cows, sheep, lambs, goats, veal, springbok. Not even sure what a springbok is. Then you have the fowl. They're not allowed to eat any type of animal that is a predator. Okay, so eagles, owls, swans, pelicans, vultures, storks, this would not be allowed, nor the eggs from these birds. Only birds that are traditionally considered kosher, such as goose, duck, chicken, turkey, may be eaten. Then you have the dairy, and dairy gets really confusing, guys. That's why this whole kosher scam, not even they can meet their standards at the end of the day. They can't do it. All kosher milk products must derive from kosher animals. Well, think about it. How are you going to have kosherized milk when you've got a production facility that has – I mean, I was out at Al Arai, which is the largest dairy here in the Middle East, and it is the most productive dairy in the world. It's run actually by New Zealanders, by the way.
Oh, really?
And they, it's New Zealand run, but it is an absolutely super efficient farm, dairy farm. They treat the cows like they are rock stars.
Right.
I kid you not. No,
right.
Because they found that by treating the animals really, really well and giving them really, really good scientifically engineered food and just making sure that they're bathed often.
Yeah, yeah.
They are given showers. They are given misters when it gets hot in the summer. These, I swear, the cows are the rock stars of outcry.
You know what? I'm glad to hear that, Dennis, because that's really where it is, right? If we want to have good quality stuff, we need to treat the animals right. They need to eat what they're meant to eat, grass-fed, et cetera, you know? So, yeah, that's great.
Yes, the boy, this factory, and they got four of these. They are the largest in the Middle East, and their production per cow is like double what it is in Germany. And, again, it's England run.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's just unbelievable, and the cows, they even look happy. You know, it's kind of weird, but you go and the cows are like, yeah, we're cool. We're cool. And, of course, cows, you know, they can't live forever. And when their dairy production goes down, obviously they find themselves headed to an abattoir. But nonetheless, they're treated while they're working as rock stars. So, but there's no way to know with all the superstitions that surround Jewish law relative to dairies that all these cows are actually kosher. Well, if you have kosher milk mixed with non-kosher milk, obviously in their mind that you can't drink the milk anymore.
Yeah.
So basically dairy products, kosherizing dairy products is an absurd thing. It's just a scam because there's no way you can actually control it at the end of the day. Then you've got these weird little prohibitions like you can't combine meat with milk. And then their justification, and this is just the insanity we're working with, guys. You may not cook a young animal in the milk of its mother.
Right, right.
Okay. Because of that, they're saying, okay, well, you can't have cheese and beef together. That's the logic.
And what is it, like, is 6 hours or something like that? What is it between? And that's why, of course, they have they have two kitchens in many of their houses, too.
Yeah, they actually do. Or though, like in my ex-girlfriend from high school, they actually didn't have two kitchens, but they had two different sets of utensils. One for this, one for that.
Exactly, yeah.
Sets of utensils. Eggs. The eggs of kosher birds, of course, are permitted if they don't contain blood. Well, how are you going to know if there's blood in there to begin with, right? Okay, unless you, of course, open it up and examine it, right? Only fish with fins and scales can be eaten. Tuna, salmon, things like that, shellfish, and shrimp, of course, are a no-no. Crabs would not work. Mussels, I guarantee you, they're not going to get oysters. They're not going to be eating oysters anytime soon. And then, of course, fruits and vegetables. There's rules about fruits and vegetables. Interesting thing about wine. Wine can only be made by Jews.
That's right. I remember seeing the Ultra Zionist. It was a pretty good documentary with, forget his first name, Thoreau something, a Canadian guy. And they showed how Christians were volunteering, and they were crying because they were so happy that they could help this one Jewish guy to make his wine. But then he said at the end of the day, when they were to roll in the barrels to make the final process, that, you know, the Christians were obviously not let in there because they were unclean, you see, so they couldn't be part of this process, you know.
And this comes back to an old superstition, because in the old days, I'm talking about the real pagan days, wine was always made with an invocation to the gods, which would then be counter to their god, this barbaric sky god that they worship. So they would not allow any type of non-Jewish person near the wine because they were afraid that the wine would be blessed in the name of a god that's not their god.
Yep.
That's the reasoning behind that.
Yep.
Then you've got the various beverages like grapes and grape-based derivatives can only be drunk if the grapes come from a kosher winery. Well, how much would it cost you to certify that winery? And then you've got all this rabbinical supervision that goes with it. Now, the interesting thing about, because what we're really talking about is what Jews want us to believe is that their food is more fit for consumption than our food at the end of the day.
Right.
Boy, if you get that circle U, your sales are going to increase. Yeah, they're going to increase because you're going to get preference, guys. That's why your sales are increasing. And you're not going to get access to certain stores without it. You know, they're not telling you that part of the story. But you've got all of these idiosyncrasies relative to Jewish dietary laws that it becomes so convoluted that you have to be insanely into this system like the rabbis are to even remotely come close to even trying to follow what they're thinking. Now, what makes salt kosher? Can you tell me?
I have no idea.
There is no such thing as kosher salt.
I see it all the time in the store, though, of course, but yeah.
Salt is a mineral, and as such, it is kosher to begin with.
Yeah.
So therefore, the salt, it's already kosher to start with, but it's being what we call kosherized. In other words, they're just working on it, putting a label, and then they say, well, gee, if you get it kosherized, you're going to be 100% sure that there's not something else in the salt that makes it not kosher.
Hmm.
See, that they're thinking that, oh, you know, we're going to put something in the salt, like, duh, right? We already have our GMP standards and practices. Of course nothing's going to be put into the salt. All they're doing is giving it this image of saying, hey, we went to the factory, we saw that this is salt, I'm the rabbi, I saw it, here's my circle U, guys, you can have your circle U.
Yeah.
Now let's play real quick a game of dietary logic, just to understand how convoluted these guys really are, okay? When boiling eggs, you need to boil at least 3 at a time. Can you tell me why?
Superstition?
Of course it's superstition. If remember, we talked about blood in one egg, and you can't eat it, right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
You boil 3, and one of those had blood in it. Well, the other 2 are going to be now the majority, and consequently, since the majority of the eggs didn't have blood in it, it's okay to eat it.
Ah, I see.
See, this is Jewish logic here. Now, flour must be sieved using a silk screen net sieve as the normal metal or plastic ones have holes that are too big. Hmm. Why would that be so?
Yeah.
Because any insect that might be in there is forbidden. So therefore, you must sieve it at a smaller degree because you can't have any insects in there. See,
that's the
logic here. Now, although eating insects would be forbidden under Jewish law, it's not for the Yemen Jews. Yemeni Jews are actually allowed to eat locusts. And for Yemen Jews, it's considered kosher. But for non-Yemen Jews, it's not considered kosher. See how confusing this starts to get? Mm-hmm. Because there are no real rules at the end of the day. And the more we look into Jewish dietary laws, especially regarding dairy, the rabbis are so in disagreement that there's real, there is no way to reconcile what these guys are saying.
Sorry to interrupt, Dennis, but that's probably maybe even why then you've had these, splinter rabbis that have broken off from the main labeling and try to kind of start up things on their own. And you have these very small independent, I guess, that are also trying to seek to get their stamp on different products, right?
That is correct, because maybe this religion, this sect believes this type of rule, this sect believes that type of rule. So to meet that they're with their parishioners, they're going to say, okay, I certified this, so it meets this rule, you can have it. If you know, that's absolutely what is happening. So
yeah.
You've kind of called that one. As you know, we talked about you can't eat meat and cheese together. And I always used to think, because, you know, I've got the Isisian codes, you know, and I think, okay, the goddess Isis is always known as the cow. And when you look at the cow sacrifices for mankind so much at the end of the day, right? It is bred to be slaughtered, to be eaten. It's very patient. When we look at certain things like words like a coward, you know, it's vilifying the fact that it's the goddess, you know, because, you know, a cow and a coward, you know, not fighting type of thing.
Mm.
You know, when you talk about transmutation on an esoteric level, you know, the cow, it eats the hay or the alfalfa, and then it goes through four levels of transmutation in its stomach before it comes out as milk.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how the occult works. It goes through many, many layers of transmutation. So I've always found the cow to be an esoterically interesting animal. And
yeah.
So when you've got the cheese, which is like the purity of the cow, you know, after she's finished processing and creating the milk, and then you have the cow itself, you have... And then combining it, it's like this super esoteric symbol of the goddess at the end of the day, you know. So in the old days, you know, people used to, like the cannibals, when you ate something, you used to believe, you know, like you're going to partake of the essence of that person, you know, the soul of that person, like cannibalism. Same with food, you know, when you partook of a particular food, you kind of partake of the essence of that animal. And that's actually very, very true. You know, there's some truth to you are what you eat type of concept.
Sure.
And
yeah.
It holds true with Taoism. And it holds true with us, too. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you do partake of the essence of what you eat.
Absolutely, yeah.
And in this case, you know, to me, it's like, you know, they want to vilify the cheeseburger because they just, at the end of the day, they want to get you as far away from the goddess as possible because you have to be as far away from the goddess as possible to actually want to be Jewish, you know, because otherwise you're not going to want to be Jewish. It would be my point of view. Now, this prohibition of eating meat and cheese together, Sephardic Jews are going to wait 4 hours, okay?
Right.
And then that is after eating chicken, before they'll drink milk. Hmm. And then 6 hours after beef. Now, why? Who knows? I'll tell you what, man, after a good cheeseburger, washing that sucker down with a nice chocolate shake is, you can eat that.
Okay? Right, yeah.
Or putting a nice slice of bacon on that sucker, you're not going to beat this type of food at the end of the day, you know. I always wonder why they vilified the pig, by the way. But
yeah, that is interesting. I don't know if you caught the interview we did with Lash, but I could recommend that for people on, we talked about the archontic infection, and he actually brought up the consumption of pork as a kind of a, I guess as a kind of a inhibiting aspect to preventing an archontic infection, which I thought was very interesting. So who knows? Maybe there's something deeper behind it.
Yeah. Now, Dutch Jews, by the way, they're going to wait only 1 hour between milk and meat. You know, being Dutch, you know, I mean, they can't go too long. And British are going to wait for 3 hours. So, again, we see even in this area, there isn't really a set standard here. It depends on the cultural differences of Jewish communities themselves. Wine, of course, we talked, it must be made by Jews only for it to become kosher. Again, this comes from the fact that wine was often used in pagan ceremonies. It's really that simple.
Yeah.
And it was often sanctified in the preparation process. So many observant, all actually observant Jews won't drink wine that's not even opened by a Jew. So you can't even have a waiter come and open your wine for you if you're really an observant Jew. You're going to say, no, please give me the corkscrew. I will open it myself.
Right, right.
One more thing, like, you know, not all animals, you know, a lot of animals out there might actually meet Jewish dietary law, like a giraffe. You know, a giraffe is kosher.
It has split hooves and chews the chud.
Cud. But the problem is the darn neck is so high, they can't hang the thing upside down to kill it.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's right. It's about that process, too, right? How you actually slit the throat and all that?
You slit the throat and yep. All the things you do to pull it, it's just too big of an animal to actually handle. So even though it's a kosher animal, they just don't have the technology to actually
eat it. Missing out on those giraffe burgers, I guess, huh?
Find your favorite talkers and discover some new ones. It's free, readily available online or on mobile with any smartphone or tablet. Finding your favorite talk shows all in one place has gotten a whole lot easier. Just go to TalkStreamLive.com. Be sure to download the free apps from Google Play or the iTunes App Store.
Do you or a loved one suffer migraine headaches? Listen to what scientist Kurt Hendricks has to say.
If you are one of the millions of people who get migraines, you need to know about MigRelief. Hi, I'm Kurt Hendricks, the scientist who created MigRelief, the patented dietary supplement that addresses nutritional deficiencies in adults and children with migraines. Thousands of physicians and pharmacists recommend MigRelief.
Call 800-MIG-7354 or visit MIG911.com.
Extendivite is more than just a heart tonic. Most basic diseases are caused by yeast in the gut and metals in the liver, and we all have a bit of both. The garlic in Extendivite has a yeast-killing effect in the gut while also helping the sulfur enzyme in the liver get rid of the metals. Extendivite just may improve your overall health. Products like Extendivite are the only way we are going to get our society healthy. And if you're waiting for the government and pharmaceutical care to solve your health problems, you're going to have a long, disappointing wait, I think. Extendivite is a complete formula for extended life in the new millennium. 80 can be the new 60. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Do you know there is an ongoing war right here in America? Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
And also we talked about the milk. It's impossible really to have kosher milk unless you're actually there milking it yourself and bottling it yourself.
Yeah.
It's possible, which in today's world is actually kind of illegal. They want to make raw milk in America a crime, you know, literally complete with SWAT team raids. So it's kind of interesting there.
So let me just take that example then, because it's a good point you raised it earlier, but I wanted to go back and revisit that. You could, for example, have any chain really of you know, franchise stores, supermarkets, etc. But for example, I would reckon then a place like Whole Foods, for example, they probably have that requirement, as you said, to end up on the shelves in there. You have to have, you know, the kosher mark on there in some capacity, and as an extension to that process, you could have, if you want to try to seek and get a stamp on your product, you're probably also going to get them then coming into your production line, not only telling you how to do things, but also telling you who to buy from, right? So if they have a good friend, you know, somewhere that they know, the rabbi, they would say, well, you know what, to make this product kosher, you need to buy your sugar from this guy, or your wheat from this guy, or what have you, right? So it's a way to expand their business empire, right?
That's exactly what is happening. I mean, if you want to get your wheat here, your whey powder, you have to go buy that whey powder from a kosher authorized facility. If you want to get a vanilla extract, that has to be kosherized. Literally every single item in the supply chain must be kosherized. So for Jews to tell us this has no value, please, you know, enough of your lies. It's too much. It costs way too much. If I have 12 items, I swear all 12 items must be kosherized.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Plus all the equipment that it's made on. So yeah, of course, if you're going to get kosherized and you don't know where to get some powder, you can go to the Orthodox Union website and probably there's a list of manufacturers that are approved.
Yeah, exactly. Well, interesting. So if this is kind of something which in reality is more or less, let's talk about when it first came in, right? And where this started. It's a cultural tradition, religious, and ultimately I don't have a problem with that. It's just when this is to be imposed on, of course, you know, Gentile society and everyone else, and everyone else has adapted these and now pay money and all that. We'll talk more about that later. But how did they manage to get this in? When was the first kind of introduction of this? When was this beginning? Do you know, Dennis?
It really goes back, at least it's really big in the U.S., by the way, more than the rest of the world. It's not so big in the U.K. The U.K. really, it's specialized. So, and that's how it should be. If you want to go to a kosher store, you have specialized companies making kosherized food, and you go to these kosher. I have no problem with what they're doing in the
right.
U.K.
Yeah.
What I have a problem with is this subterfuge that's costing the Americans maybe $200 out of everybody's pocket every year. And this really goes back to really around the 1920s to 1930s. But really the development can even be traced back further than that, maybe like 200 years. Because, you know, they have these really strange ideas, you know, they're superstitions. So this idea of kosher supervision in the United States, you know, Jews have been planning this for a long time. You know, it goes back to colonial times. As early as 1660, there was this Jewish guy from Portugal. He applied for a license to sell kosher meat in New Amsterdam. So it goes way back. And we had the first recorded complaint against a abattoir or a butcher going back to 1771. And in 1774, the widow of Hefty Hayes, whoever that would have been, complained that her ritual slaughterer was selling non-kosher meat. So we have complaints now going all the way back then, and this led to the actual first court license revocation against a kosher butcher in 1796. So we know that historically it goes back quite a number of years. But in the U.S., it really starts to take off around 1920s, 1930s with the Orthodox Union. You know, by 1918, I think kosher products really started to find their way into the American market.
I'm getting older and noticing that my body just doesn't work as well as it used to. So I like to keep fit as possible by hitting the gym a few times a week. Recently, I started having a nagging bicep pain and it got so bad I couldn't even lift the weights. When I was complaining about it to a friend, he told me about Angioprim. He said chelation helps remove toxins, heavy metals, and cholesterol in veins and arteries that may cause blockages. You know, after just 1 week of taking Angioprim, the pain was gone and now I'm back in the gym full strength. Scientific research proves the active ingredient in Angioprim has superior oral chelation action that helps promote cardiovascular health. So to learn more, go to angioprim.com. That's angioprim.com. Or talk to a trained consultant. Call Angioprim toll free at 877 888 872-7221. You'll feel better with more energy. Call 877-882-7221 or go to the website angioprim.com.
I think Heinz Vegetarian Beans actually was one of the very first products ever. Abraham Goldstein, he was a chemist. He was highly instrumental in